Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
So the title of this talk is Creation versus Creationism, Aquinas on Evolution. And I think this is a great topic for the Thomistic Institute, and it's part of why the Thomistic Institute exists, to grapple with questions like this about the intelligibility of faith in light of contemporary science and vice versa. I'd like to start with some clarifying remarks, kind of some introductory remarks, although we could talk about them for a long time, really, about the apparent conflict or the illusion of conflict between science and faith. And there's lots of arguments here, but I think by beginning with a few general observations, and maybe I should be using this if I can try. Is that better? I think they can... We won't have time to get into all of these arguments. We can helpfully group some of them together and just analyze them in summary fashion. I think there's kind of four general headings here. So if I could give you, these are like four objections that then we will, I hope, resolve either immediately or as the talk goes on. The first is probably the easiest to deal with. It holds that science has disproved the Bible. Because there are passages, now this is the objection, right? There are passages in the Bible, according to this view, like the creation account found in Genesis, that are inimical to what contemporary science tells us, and there we might think of evolution in the theory in biology, or, for that matter, Big Bang cosmology, although, you know, that may look a little more friendly to what the faith holds. So that's the first category of objections. The second kind of confusion, I think, stems from the claim that science can, or in theory could, explain all that religion tries to account for. So, for example, someone might claim that the whole cosmos is simply indeterminate chaos or randomness out of which apparent order has spontaneously emerged. And that, of course, is related to the claim made by some strong proponents of evolutionary biology that you can account for human beings and for all of the other diverse orders of organic life by appealing to random genetic mutation and natural selection. So on this view, religious explanations, like what you read in Genesis or elsewhere in the Bible, are superfluous at a minimum, because we already have the explanation, or at worst, they positively obscure and impede our advance in knowledge. So they're at least misleading, but at worst, they might be positively deforming how we think. I think that's a false claim, but that is the claim. The third alleged conflict goes something like this: faith claims of religion are limits to scientific inquiry, and they use non-scientific criteria to constrain our investigation or our knowledge of the truth. And then a fourth category goes something like this: because faith claims are empirically unverifiable, they simply don't count as claims about objective reality. They're sort of like esoterica. The only thing that really counts as true are things that can be empirically verified by the scientific method. So since faith claims can't be verified, we shouldn't even count them as true. Okay, so those are my four objections. I don't think these hold up, but I wanted to get them out there at the start. Now, how do we show that these are only apparent conflicts? Okay, so let me start with a little disclaimer. I am not a scientist. My specialties are philosophy and theology. And I've done a fair amount of work to try and inform myself about the science, including exchanges with serious scientists. But I don't want to pretend to have a properly scientific background that could finally resolve some of these scientific questions. So in response to these four things, I'd like to offer some general principles, especially principles drawn from traditional Thomistic philosophy and theology, which clarify the relationship between faith and science and dispel some of these illusions of conflict. And then from there, I'd like to discuss in like the second part of the talk some of the specific questions that arise when we talk about evolution and God's creation of our first parents from a Catholic perspective, and try and give a kind of Catholic or Thomistic account of that. Okay, so the first part of the talk then is dealing with these misconceptions, and I'll try to do that rather quickly. So the first point in response to that first objection. The first objection was, well, science has disproven the Bible. And the short answer here is, this often involves a misunderstanding of what the Bible is saying. At least from a Catholic perspective, we don't read the accounts of, say, the book of Genesis or other creation accounts in the Bible. And in fact, there are multiple other creation accounts in the Bible, not just in Genesis. But we don't read those accounts as historical accounts of a particular sequence of events. Even less do we read them as a scientific account of the origin of the cosmos or of human life. In other words, what you find in Genesis and in Sirach and in the Book of Wisdom and in the Psalms and in the prologue of John's Gospel and the other places where you find a creation account is a different kind of literature than scientific or strictly historical literature in the modern sense of those words. The Bible is trying to tell us something different. It is offering us a highly theological account, often clothed in rich symbols, and it expresses deep truths. So the Bible really is communicating important truths, but it is not trying to claim, for example, that there were literally 6 days in which God created heaven and earth, meaning 24 earth hours or something like that, or that there was a physical serpent telling the woman to eat the real fruit of a real tree in the garden. In fact, as one colleague of mine once remarked, Origen has a remark about, you know, the account of the tree in the garden, Origen being one of the early church fathers, that, you know, if you read this and you think it's a story about an actual tree, you are an idiot. And in fact, if you were trying to write a historical account or a scientific account, you would not put the two Genesis creation accounts right next to each other because they are obviously not directly coherent with each other in terms of the literal sequence that they recount. So you would have to be an idiot to put them together and think that you were making claims about the actual historical sequence. What you should take from that is the point of those passages is not the literal sequence as a historical matter. It's trying to tell us something else, something very important, and so we should not be confused when it doesn't match up with, say, you know, what contemporary cosmology discovers about the age of the universe or something like that. Okay, that's like the first easy point to deal with. The second point, which is a more important philosophical point, is necessary really to understand the relationship between God and the way God causes things in the world and the way creatures cause things in the world. And this is absolutely fundamental for understanding the relationship between faith and science, and also for understanding a Catholic view of evolution. Because, of course, we want to say that it's possible for creaturely causes to lead to a process of biological evolution, and that this is compatible with God's transcendent causality of the whole of creation and of each individual creature. And there is a very elegant way to do that, and St. Thomas Aquinas is one of its great proponents. So this is the first and most important real principle that I want to talk about. And I think we can label it the principle of the transcendent primacy of God. Or, if any of you know Monsignor Robert Sokolowski, who has taught here for many years, do you know who that is? Have any of you taken his classes? Okay, we have only one person. Okay, if I give no other homework to this group, it would be like, see if you can get in one of Monsignor Sokolowski's classes before you leave Catholic U. I mean, he's now emeritus. I don't know how many classes he's still teaching, but he is one of the greats here at Catholic U. Monsignor Sokolowski has written a book about this, where he talks about what he calls the Christian distinction, or we might say the Judeo-Christian distinction. The idea here is that the Christian understanding of God, or I think more properly, the Judeo-Christian understanding of God, does not see God as a part of the universe, like the highest and noblest part. That is the way the pagans in antiquity thought about the gods. The gods were the noblest part of the universe. So if we were to draw a circle and say, okay, the very upper part of the circle is where the gods are, and we are way down below, but we're all in this universe. For Christianity, God is not a part of the universe, nor is God simply outside of the universe as separate from it. Rather, he is the source of the universe itself, its absolutely transcendent and primary cause. Which means, therefore, that everything we encounter in the universe is already related to God as its transcendent first cause. And it also means that God does not relate to other things in the world the same way that things in the world relate to other things in the world. Do you follow what I'm saying? God is the transcendent cause of the whole, and he has a relation to each individual in that whole, which is a different kind of relation than the things between individuals within the universe. Here's another way to put it. And, this is forcing you to sort of stretch your minds. I assume here at Catholic University, you're used to doing that in your philosophy or theology classes. We are often accustomed to thinking of creation as a moment in time, like the first moment. For St. Thomas Aquinas, creation is not a moment in time, nor is it simply a beginning point after which things more or less unfold on their own. Rather, for Aquinas, creation specifies a relation of radical ontological dependence of creatures on God. So, to be a creature means to receive being, to be caused, not to be or to exist in an absolute sense. Only God exists in that absolute way. Every creature exists in only a relative way, relative to its dependence on God. So when you begin to think about the consequences this has for understanding who God is and what the universe is in relation to him, it is kind of mind-bending, because you could put it this way. The universe could possibly not have been, in which case, God would have been all that is. Okay? Are you with me so far? In that case, there would not have been any decrease of goodness or greatness or being. God plus the world is not greater than just God. Okay, that is very hard for us to grasp, but what it's trying to express is that in a certain way, creaturely being is sharing somehow in God's being. And God is absolutely primary, and creatures are very relative to him. And so relative that compared to him, we are, as it were, nothing. Aquinas' deepest account of this is that God is pure being, or absolute being, or what he says in Latin, ipsum esse subsistens. Okay, so all creatures could possibly not be, but God cannot possibly not be. That is why, according to Aquinas, we have to think of God in a radically different way than we think of creatures. God is pure being, creatures are contingent being. And that also means that God cannot be investigated in the same way as we investigate other beings in the world, because he is not a part of the world. He is the transcendent cause of the world. Okay. What flows from this Judeo-Christian distinction, which is the distinction between all creatures and God, flows a second important principle, which is also really important for understanding the Catholic account of evolution. And we can label this distinction the distinction between primary causality and secondary causality. How many of you have heard of this before? Okay, a few of you. Oh, you know, it's more than half. All right, so I'm going to give just a very brief summary, and if you have questions, we can follow up during the Q&A. Okay, God simply is, and he gives to creatures their being and therefore also their power to be causes. So when we talk about God's causality of the very being of things, we're talking about his first causality or primary causality. When we talk about the causality that creatures have in the world, we're talking about a causality that depends on God's first causality. So we can call it secondary causality. Okay, when we say secondary, however, and this is a very important point, we don't mean to say that it's unimportant or that their secondary causes are only kind of causes, you know, quasi-causes or something like that. No, that's not what I'm saying. Secondary causes are genuine causes, and their causality has a kind of integrity and relative autonomy within the created order. But what we're picking out when we call them secondary is that they are caused causes. They are causes that depend on God as the first cause. Their causal power comes from him, just as their being depends on him. Okay, so this helps us to see that the result of a secondary cause on another being in the world is really caused by that other creature. So like if, I don't know, if I were to throw this water bottle at Claire and make her wet, we could say that I caused her to be wet. I did not think about a good example beforehand, so this is probably not a good one, but let's go with it. Okay. Or maybe better, we could talk about the music in the next room and say, like, whoever's playing that music is causing me to be struggle to communicate the profound and important truths that I'm trying to communicate to you. We don't want to say that God is directly doing that without the mediation of the people in the next room. But it's true to say that that really is causing noise in here, and in a certain sense, God is the first cause of this whole reality, giving them their causal power to disrupt my talk. I don't know, that now this is starting to work against me, right? Because I'm trying to think that God wants me to give this talk, but maybe this is evidence to the contrary. Okay, are you following what I'm trying to say here? Secondary causes act in virtue of their having received their causal power from God. So it's true to say that the secondary cause really is a cause. It's also true to say that God is acting through the causality of these secondary causes. So we can say both and perhaps you see where this is going when we're talking about the theory of evolution. What does contemporary biological science do when it is studying the evolution of organisms? It is studying creatures in the world. It's studying, and often from a rather material standpoint. You know, it's studying the proteins or the DNA replication and the other environmental factors, the way that species gain a particular evolutionary advantage by certain traits that then get passed on and are sort of amplified through the course of natural selection. Okay, it's looking at that whole realm of causes within the world. And it's certainly possible, theoretically at least, that God is accomplishing his purposes through that network of secondary causes. In other words, to ascribe real causality to these biological processes in the world in no way is a problem for the Catholic faith when it says that God is the transcendent creator of the world. Because God is perfectly capable of creating secondary causes that produce effects in the world that then, you know, produce further effects and so forth. And so it is simply a mistake to think that somehow evolution has pushed God out of the picture. Now this is maybe a very summary argument here, but I think this distinction between primary and secondary causality is very powerful and also leads to a very positive regard that Catholicism has towards natural science. Why? Because all of the things in the world have come from God, and they can all be studied by us as creatures. We can bracket off the fact that God has created them, and we can just study them. And when we do that, we really learn the truth about those things. So we don't need to be worried about scientific investigation. It is a very, very good thing to do, as long as we do not think that that scientific investigation is now making claims about God. Rather, it's making claims about the creatures that have come from God. So in a certain way, we are honoring God when we investigate those secondary causes, as long as we understand that they come ultimately from him. Okay, third key principle, God's providence. The universe is characterized by order. And the intelligibility of that order can in some way be grasped by our minds and investigated by us in various ways, even put to work in service of our own projects and our own ends. God is the source of all that is, and likewise, he is the source of that order that we find in the world. In fact, if there were not order in the world, we could not do science, which depends on the regularity of these phenomena, the fact that there are, for example, laws of thermodynamics, for example, is a principle of order that is fundamental for our investigation of the universe. The fact that the universe is permeated with order ultimately must be traced back to the mind of God. Now, here we might encounter an objection. Perhaps I am making it sound like God is the most perfect physicist who sets up the laws of thermodynamics or the laws of causation. He sets the initial conditions and he's calculated how everything is going to play out, and then he starts the universe rolling and then it all unfolds according to those laws. That may sound a little bit like the famous theory of Laplace, which is that if you know all the relevant laws and you know the initial conditions, you can determine everything. Okay, what's wrong with this perspective from a Catholic view? It's once again to think of God in a too creaturely way, as if God were like a scientist creating a system in the world. God's way of ordering things is much higher than ours. And his way of causing things is much higher than our ability to cause. So God doesn't just take things and bump them into other things so that that causal power like continues on down the chain. God is the transcendent cause of each of those things. He gives them their very being and their natures, their power to cause. He causes different orders of things. And this is a very important thing to understand, to begin to see the false dichotomy sometimes posed in scientific circles between positing, on the one hand, a kind of chaos or absolute randomness, pure indeterminacy, that somehow gives rise to ordered dynamic systems, with, on the other hand, the view that all things are determined by physical causes and forces. So the one is like strongly not determined, the other is strongly determined. In fact, for Aquinas, neither of these views is correct, because there are different kinds of secondary causes that interact in complex ways, so that there is neither pure indeterminacy in the world, nor a pure physical determinism. Rather, God is a providential governor who orders all things. And some things have per se effects. They are per se causes. They cause always and in the same way. They might result in a particular effect always, or for the most part. Physical laws are like this. And what biologists normally look at are also normally like this. These are per se causes. A billiard ball strikes another billiard ball. You see the effect, causes the other ball to move, happens always or for the most part. A sperm fertilizes an egg and a new organism results, always or for the most part, that causal sequence obtains. Okay, these are per se causes according to Aquinas. But those are not the only kinds of causes in the world. There are also causes that St. Thomas Aquinas calls per accidens causes. These are things that Aquinas also would call chance occurrences. Here you have intersecting lines of causality that bring about a result that is much harder to predict, although it's not maybe impossible to do so. The classic example of a per accidens cause would be if we think about Claire and Simon, who have organized this talk. And suppose Claire owes $20 to Simon. Both go to Starbucks from their dorm rooms, and they run into each other there. The result of that encounter is that Claire repays $20 to Simon. But you could ask, did Claire go to Starbucks to repay Simon? The answer would be no. Did Simon go to Starbucks to be repaid by Claire? The answer would be no. Okay, they went with their own intentions, and it just so happened that they bumped into each other there, and it resulted in this debt being repaid. So this is a classic example of two causes not pointing at the result, but the result coming about nonetheless through the intersection of these lines of causality. Now think about the example of a fertilized egg, and this brings us a little closer to the theory of evolution. In the line of per se causality, what happens when a sperm fertilizes an egg? You get a new organism, right? But suppose that the egg has just been exposed to a dose of radiation, causing genetic mutations. Now the fertilization happens. Do you get the same per se cause or per se effect as you would have had absent that radiation? Well, depends on how much radiation there was. Something different will probably result. Probably no new life. Maybe some new organism with significant differences. Maybe defects, most probably deformities or defects. But maybe genetic advantages. That would be not very likely, but perhaps could happen. Okay, so there we have an example of per accidens causes, which are not determined per se, but they do bring about a genuinely new result. Having an understanding of the fact that there's lots of causes in the world and they interact in this way, bringing about new results is, like, that's of course obvious if you're talking about the theory of evolution. What if God is able to understand and act within each of those contingent causes as they are working and intersecting? Aquinas thinks that God's viewpoint on all of this is not like our viewpoint, but one that is outside of the universe and undergirding it at every moment, and so understanding from within how each thing is behaving and will behave. So God is acting in a different order, especially as a cause. He is able to use these very contingent causes in the world to bring about a result that he knows with certitude will happen. Even though someone in the world does not know that it will happen. And in fact, from a perspective inside the world, you could not know that it would happen. But that is not a limitation for God's causality. The classic illustration of this that St. Thomas Aquinas uses is if you were standing on a high mountain with a road in the valley below you. Has anyone here, I think maybe at least one will answer yes here. Has anyone here been to Aquinas' birthplace, Aquino? Okay, I knew that there was at least one. If you go on the Thomistic Institute Study Abroad program, you will go to the birthplace of Aquinas, and it's a beautiful spot. Aquinas was born in a castle on a high mountain, really kind of like a long ridge, overlooking an enormous valley south of Rome. And the highway runs down that valley, and it's an ancient highway running from Rome to Naples. So Aquinas' example is this. If you are on a high mountain and you're looking at the road, and you look way down there at this end of the road, you see someone traveling from right to left. And then you look to your left and you see someone way down there, miles away, traveling from left to right. You know that those two people are going to meet somewhere in the middle. But neither of them knows that this is going to happen. Okay, has your knowledge that this is going to happen in the future determined their actions in any causal way? No, you have not determined what they are going to do, but you can know infallibly that it is going to happen. God can know, and in fact, God can set them off on their paths according to their own intentions. As secondary causes, they are going to act like their secondary causes, and God can know and intend the result that happens when they meet by chance. Their meeting is genuinely by chance, but it is infallibly known and caused by God, the transcendent first cause. Okay, so if we're now moving into the realm of speaking about evolution, we can see there is then a way to understand how God can be the first cause and, in fact, bring about a determinate result through contingent secondary causes without depriving them of their real contingency. And that means that biological evolution can be true without threatening the idea that God is the cause. Okay, now let me start to shift gears a little bit, because I want to talk about the creation accounts in Genesis, but before doing that, I want to make one final point. The things that science is doing, or you might say the more proper way to say this, the formal object of scientific investigation is different from what philosophy does and what theology does. And that does not mean that because what philosophy and theology do are not using the scientific method, they are not discovering important truths about reality. It just means that they work according to a different method. So here's an example. A physicist can build a nuclear bomb. So physics is able to tell you how to do that. But a physicist cannot answer using the scientific method as a physicist whether dropping the bomb on this city is morally good or justified or is morally evil. There is no empirically verifiable experiment you can run to make that judgment. You cannot use the scientific method to investigate questions of justice or injustice. But that does not mean that questions about justice or injustice are unreal or unimportant. In fact, what I'm trying to illustrate with this example is that they're extremely important, and maybe even more important than the knowledge about how to build the bomb. If you can build a bomb, but you cannot judge when it might be used, or perhaps that it should never be used, then you are not growing in wisdom. The inquiry about justice is a different sort of inquiry, but it is not a less important one because it does not use the scientific method. Nor do we want to say that the inquiry about justice is an irrational one, or one not based on reason. There are reasons you can give why you should not destroy a city with an atomic bomb. They are just not reasons that the scientific method can demonstrate. Rather, this requires philosophy, which is why philosophy is, in a certain way, a higher science or a higher discipline than the natural sciences. We could also talk about theology. If Jesus were standing here in his human body, which would be wonderful if that happened, you could not run a test on his right arm, say, to see if you could detect whether he is God or whether the divinity has united itself to a human nature in the person of the Son, as the Catholic faith professes. Because that God became man is a truth or a claim that is theological. And even though science could investigate the human body of Jesus as a biological reality or as a physical reality, the scientific method cannot investigate Jesus as God or as the revealer of the Father. Okay, so in a similar way, you can study your roommate in different ways. I don't know if you've tried to study your roommate. You could study your roommate as, for example, an object of physics, like as throwable. I don't really recommend throwing your roommate, but some people do. You could study your roommate as an object of biology, as living, breathing, digesting, emitting foul odors, you know? You could study your roommate as an object of psychology, that is, as having certain manias or phobias or neuroticism. You know, and maybe I'm getting, you know, close to home, or maybe you say, no, no one at Catholic U is like that. You could study your roommate as a moral actor, as possessing virtue or vices. Okay, so if you study your roommate as throwable, you are in the domain of physics, natural science. As an object of biology, okay, a different type of natural science. Object of psychology, getting a little more spiritual, but still connected to the brain, for example. When you begin to talk about the moral life of your roommate, like virtues and vices, you are in the realm of philosophy. You could also study your roommate as possessing the state of grace, and here you're in the domain of theology. You cannot investigate by the scientific method whether your roommate has the virtue of faith or the virtue of charity. What the scientific method can analyze, then, is only a slice of the realm of important truths. Reality is more than what science can investigate, which is not to say that scientific investigation is not important. It is very important. It just isn't absolutely comprehensive. Truth is larger than what science can discover. And some truths are of themselves not discoverable by the scientific method. I've already given you a number of examples, but let me give you two more. This one is very topical at this very moment. Whether you like this talk, like I cannot know that directly. I could maybe infer it from the fact that some of you are smiling and others have a very blank expression, and maybe some of you have your eyes closed, okay? So that would be one, like, how do I know if you like this talk? Well, for the most part, you're going to have to tell me. And then I can ask, should I believe this person? It's certainly the regular experience of priests after celebrating Mass. You're standing outside the church, and people come out, and they shake your hand, and they say, nice homily, Father. And you're like, I get a lot of nice homily, Fathers, you know? Like, how many of them really mean that? And maybe some of them do, but maybe not all. Okay, it's hard to know. But maybe that's not a very important truth. What about the truth of whether your spouse loves you or your mother loves you? This is an extremely important truth. It's a truth that you want to build your whole life on. But the scientific method cannot detect it, at least not directly. For that, you need to depend on the word of another. You can only believe what they tell you. And faith is like this. Faith is actually the most important domain, telling us the most important truths, but they are things that cannot, in principle, be known by the investigation of science. It is not unreasonable, however, to believe the word of another. It is something that we do all the time. In fact, even the scientific method depends on that. Because you could never run every science experiment that the whole body of science has amassed. You have to trust the other scientists, and it's totally reasonable to do that. If a man were to come from God and were to, in a sense, show you the supernatural proofs of that that claim by, say, coming back from the dead, perhaps you should believe the things he tells you about the Father. And I think that would be a very reasonable thing to do. That's what I wanted to say about the apparent conflict between science and evolution. And I realize we haven't yet gotten to talk about the book of Genesis. Let me say just a few brief words by way of sort of concluding summary on this. Aquinas does not think that lower causes random interactions of particles or organisms, considered purely by themselves, could give rise to higher forms of life. And this is like the most sophisticated Thomistic objection to the theory of evolution that you will sometimes encounter. But Aquinas does think that God has created a marvelous order in the universe. And I think it's kind of a foundational principle for Aquinas that any new order that we see emerging from what may to us seem like chaotic or random activity cannot be explained except by some higher principle of order. And ultimately, that has to find its place in God. But we could posit that there are principles of order in the world that we do not yet directly perceive that are, in fact, the causes in the world of the what appears to be spontaneously generated order coming from below, from secondary causes. I think that's a very important principle. What then about what we read in the book of Genesis? How do we put, say, the creation story of Adam and Eve together with what I've been talking about? The first point, if we're going to talk about the book of Genesis, and I'm going to try to do that in about, let's say, 5 minutes, and then I will conclude, is that Adam and Eve show up in chapter 2 of the book of Genesis. This is the second creation account, following immediately after the account of the 6 days recounted in Genesis chapter 1. Okay, these two accounts, chapter 1 and chapter 2, were probably written by different human authors at different times and were later put together to form a single book by an editor, we suppose. These human authors and editors were acting under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. And so we hold that this text has come down to us as a part of divine revelation, which communicates infallible truths pertaining to human salvation. But that doesn't mean that it communicates historical or scientific truths about human origins, as we've already seen. And if it were trying to do so, they did a pretty poor job because they put these conflicting texts right next to each other. So what was the story about Adam and Eve trying to tell us? Or the story about Genesis 1 and the 7 days, or the 6 days? God is revealing that he is the transcendent creator of all things. He's also revealing something about human beings. Human beings are a part of God's plan, the pinnacle of the visible creation, and capable of real spiritual acts of communion, personal relationship with God and with each other, something much more than what animals can do. Even more, God entrusts creation to the human being, giving man a dominion over the earth and all its creatures, so that man now shares in a certain way in God's own providential governance of the world. And we also learn important truths about the relationship between man and woman, who are meant for each other. It is not right for the man to be alone. And as Adam exclaims when he sees Eve for the first time, "This one is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh." And that tells us something profound about human marriage. But we also learn that something has gone very wrong in creation. And here you have the story about the first sin and the fall. Okay, so let's now subject this to some scientific critique. Did Adam and Eve really exist according to contemporary science? According to the Catholic Church, did Adam and Eve really exist? I think the answer to that is yes, but perhaps not in the way that you first think about it. So if we're asking, did Adam and Eve really exist? If we mean by that, is the story literally true? Were there two individuals named Adam and Eve and the tree and etc.? As a historical matter, is that literally true? I think that is not what the sacred text is trying to claim. I would say if you're asking that question, you're misunderstanding the text. Okay, but you could push back and say, well, wait a second. Are you saying this is all just made up? It's just a myth or it's poetry trying to tell us some truth about the human condition. That seems like it's not what Christianity has been saying for a long time. Are you saying that we had no first parents or that there were potentially many first parents? Can we trace our lineage to an original couple? Okay, these questions call, I think, for a different answer. And here, the Catholic answer is maybe a little surprising. The Catholic faith holds that God has revealed to us that we're all descendants of Adam, which is the name given in Genesis for the first true human being who was created in grace, and that after his sin, we inherit from him not only his human nature, but the wounded or fallen condition of that nature. Now, that's a theological claim about us, and we don't get it just from a simplistic reading of Genesis chapter 2. Many other texts in sacred scripture refer to our parents and the fall, especially in St. Paul's letter to the Romans, where we learn that the reason we needed a savior was because of this fall, and that it's very important that Jesus have assumed the nature that Adam possessed. So, that is to say that I think sacred scripture is not claiming to hand on precisely when our first parents lived, or to give an eyewitness account of their sin. Nonetheless, the Bible read as a whole is teaching us that human beings had our origin in a first human being or in an original couple who really existed at some point in the distant past. Okay, is that compatible with contemporary scientific research? Genetics today has uncovered a tremendous wealth of knowledge about the biological ancestry of the human race. So, for example, we know with a high degree of probability that Homo sapiens mated with Neanderthals perhaps tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of years ago, and that all of us have some Neanderthal DNA, and very likely Mary of Nazareth had Neanderthal DNA, which would mean Jesus of Nazareth had Neanderthal DNA. Very interesting. Okay, but how far can we push the scientific and genetic analysis of this kind of inquiry? Because genetic research is looking at our genetic code, it cannot identify at what point in the past a hominin animal received the gift of a rational soul. That is, biology alone cannot identify the transition from an advanced animal to what we would call theological humans, that is, human beings with a mind able to know and love God and therefore an immortal spiritual soul. That, theologically speaking, is the creation that Genesis is speaking about. The moment when, from whatever pre-existing reality there was, God infused a spiritual principle from above. And it is entirely possible that God would have used for a very, very long time created causes to bring about that advanced animal into which a spiritual soul was infused. And what is more, current scientific techniques face serious limits about what they can discover about when our last common ancestors were. If you have questions about that, I'm happy to talk about it in the Q&A, but I don't think any of the investigation of when our most recent common ancestor, and science has identified some common ancestors that we all have in the past, when those people lived. It's likely that we all have one common female ancestor who lived 160,000 years ago, although the science is constantly adjusting these numbers. Okay, how then might we bring together what the Bible reveals and what scientific research suggests on this point? We might theorize, and this is just my own hypothesis, really, but it's trying to make sense of the facts as we know them from Revelation and also from scientific investigation. We might theorize that a very long time ago, there was a population of advanced animals. Think hominins. Animals physically like human beings in many ways, but lacking the light of reason. And that from this population, God may have brought forth two new creatures, endowing them with rational souls, and those would be the first human beings. And those two human beings may have been living in an environment surrounded by these animals very biologically like themselves. Is it possible that there was interbreeding between those early humans and those other animals? Well, we know, according to Genesis, that the fall from grace happened very quickly. And after the fall, when sin is in the world, we also know that human beings do some terrible things. So it should not surprise us if something like that were to have happened. It would have been a terrible sin, but that's what sin looks like. And also, it's possible that any interbreeding was involuntary on the human side. Because if you can imagine a vulnerable human female, biologically very like other strong and aggressive animals, that she could be impregnated by one of them. That also would be terrible. It would be a very good reason for the human beings to hunt down and kill all of those animals. Now, I'm not saying that any of this actually happened, but it is an attempt to explain the genetic record. And sometimes what scientists will do is they'll say, oh, well, we can tell that humans must have been interbreeding with these other animals, and that is evidence that there could not have been an original couple. The genetic record is just too diffuse. But the genetic record cannot tell us who the first two theological humans were. The biology just isn't good enough to determine which of them had rational souls. So the biological evidence does not actually contradict the scriptural evidence. And since the scripture has been revealed to us and attested by God in many other ways, I believe it. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.